Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, I'm just a caveman.
Due to habeas corpus, you and Miss Bonifante had a common law marriage.
So you don't work on a contingency basis?
No, money down. Oops, shouldn't have this bar association logo here either.
Would you please point at that robot over there? No further questions.
Welcome to Opening Arguments, the podcast that pairs an inquisitive interviewer with a real-life lawyer. This podcast is sponsored by the law offices of P. Andrew Torres, LLC, for entertainment purposes, is not intended as legal advice, and does not form an attorney-client relationship. Don't take legal advice from a podcast.
Welcome to Opening Arguments. It's episode 250. Brian, I'm sure put in some good sound effects there.
Oh, I hope so.
That kind of thing.
Yeah.
I mean, mine were already so good. Maybe just use mine. Pew, pew. Boom. Cannon shot. I don't know.
Yeah. Oh, if we're going to do that, I think if we're doing pew pews and cannon shots, if he doesn't splice in some Transformer sounds, then that's not the Brian I know and love.
Well, Brian, our editor, famously just crapped all over Transformers. It was a bold thing. You know, we've talked about employer-employee power dynamics. That doesn't apply to Brian because he...
Yeah. No, he has all the power.
He just absolutely crapped all over your Transformer dreams. And, you know, it's part of the fun dynamic here we have. But anyway, we are celebrating 250 episodes of Opening Arguments. And, of course, that's not counting a billion Lot Awful movies and Q&As and all that other stuff. This is just 250 official episodes. But what an accomplishment. Andrew, give yourself... I'm not over there, but give yourself a pat on the back.
Well,
don't make
only
it too long,
if, only but... if you do likewise for me.
Okay,
no,
sure.
I'm really, really excited about this. I mean, we started August of 2016. So, you know, we're heading into our third year of doing the show. It's been successful beyond, you know, my wildest dreams. And I love doing the show, man. I really, really do. And I'm super excited that we've done 250 episodes. Wow.
Wow. That's crazy talk, but apparently that's what the numbers say. And we're going to celebrate. Here's what we're going to do. We're doing a bit of a kind of a combination of a best of and like an advertisement for the show in a way. It's like we wanted to go through and find some of Andrew's best moments, best predictions, you know, good times on the show, interesting things that happened. But also, if it might be a way, if anyone ever asks you or if you're trying to, which you should do as a good listener, spread the word about the show and people wonder, like, who are we? What's this about? Episode 250 might be a good one to start with, just to send them. Here's a little catch up. Here's what some of the highlights are. Now, obviously, this is, of course, going to be just a grossly inadequate in terms of 250, usually 60 to 90 minute episodes. You know, there's a lot that we've gone through, but this will be a little taste of what we're about. So if you want to share the show out with people, this might be a good way to say, hey, here's what these guys are all about. Now, of course, since we value our patrons so much and we always want to make sure that you've got enough content and that we're not, you know, ever derelict in our duty to provide you with great OA and Andrew goodness, we're also releasing a patron-only bonus episode that is a conversation Andrew had with Bryce Blankenagel that has some great new law stuff for you. So we didn't want to feel like we were ripping anybody off with the best of. So it's up to you. You know, if you're a longtime listener, if you've heard every episode of the show, you know, it's up to you whether you want to listen to this one, because it will have clips of old shows, but we're also going to talk about them and talk about the show. So it's up to you. And maybe you're somebody who's like, no, I've heard every episode. I know everything about the show. Hop on over to the Patreon feed and catch the bonus extra that Andrew did.
Yeah. And look, we're going to go back, you know, 3 years here. So
yeah.
I don't know. When I went through
Maybe
the clips, I was excited going through the clips and that was me talking. So hopefully everyone enjoys it. But no, I thought it was a great introduction, Thomas.
All right. So if you're new to the show, maybe you've had this shared with you. Question, Andrew, what is this show all about?
So the way I view this show, and I'm curious how you would answer that question, Thomas, but I view this show as long form, serious investigative journalism into the news, into any story that has a legal component to them. And I would add, you know, two codicils to that, right? One, we come at it from a left-leaning perspective, right? We're liberals, we're left of center. And number two, that we try not to take ourselves too seriously. We take the subject matter very, very seriously, but we try and have fun here. If I needed to condense that down into one sentence, right? So if that's the elevator pitch, the between floors in the elevator pitch that I say to people, and I really do this, is look, if you like Rachel Maddow, then you'll like our show.
I think that puts it great. And I would agree. I think that one thing I've learned from you over the years of doing this show is that the law is very complicated. There's a reason that you have to kind of, you know, get educated in order to practice the law. And oftentimes, not always, but more than half the time, the way a lot of the media covers major cases, major, you know, breaking legal news, the way they cover it is wrong. And it's unfortunate, but I guess it's good for us. It's job security for us because there's no end to how impressed I have been with Andrew. You have a job that not too many people can do because you're able to break these things down in a way where sometimes, and there's two categories we're going to see with these clips. Sometimes it's, hey, here's a thing we should be just totally alarmed about that we aren't because people haven't noticed it. Cough, Stormy Daniels, you know, kind of thing. Nobody's noticed this. We should be alarmed. But sometimes there's something that everybody is alarmed about and panicking about. And Andrew will say, you know, actually, you shouldn't be as worried about this as you might be. And I think that you have overwhelmingly been right in those kinds of interpretations and those kinds of stories. And of course, if you ever get anything wrong, you're the first to admit it. With an Andrew Was Wrong segment. So that's why you can rely on this show. I really do tell people, I'm so proud of the show, and it's because it's not me, it's you, that if you want to make sense of what's going on and the fact that the news these days with the Trump administration, so much of it requires a legal analyst, a good legal analyst who doesn't have any other agenda but wanting to explain it to you in a way that actually makes sense. It really requires that. And I think there's so much perspective that you add to these stories. So I think we should start off with some stuff that we are really proud of. And personally, I'm very proud of two major Andrew Torres Was Right kind of accomplishments. And I think we should start with Stormy Daniels.
Well, you know, that was a pretty big episode for us. It did 100,000 downloads. I was really excited about the Stormy Daniels episode. And I guess, I don't know if I've told the story on the air yet, but what happens is throughout the week, as I'm preparing for the show, I will compile stories and people will compile them for me, right? So we've thanked some of the people who do that, Deborah Smith, Ashley Smith, and Teresa Gomez in particular. And so what I do is I keep them in a little directory in my inbox, just a little opening arguments directory. And this was the first week in March. I was visiting my parents at their retirement community in Florida. And And I believe it was Deborah who sent me the very first Stormy Daniels story, which I had just kind of filed off in a directory of, okay, well, I'll look at this when I get some downtime, and maybe that'll make a good A or C segment, right? A little bookending segment, smaller. It's got a Trump angle to it. It's you know, maybe has the potential to be an amusing story because of the porn angle. And then I opened up the first story, and what I always do when I get a story is make sure that I can find the underlying court documents, right? And I pulled up the documents, and that's when I called you.
Yeah.
And I said, Thomas, we got to record on this, and we have to record on it now, because everybody is focused on a question that doesn't have the slightest thing to do with why this is a big deal. Right. And that every aspect of how that was being reported, right, it was being reported as a non-disclosure agreement. It wasn't. It's a settlement agreement. It was being reported as, does it matter if Donald Trump signed it? All of those things were utterly insignificant in comparison to what Stormy Daniels established and ultimately, you know, what set in motion, I think, potentially what could take down Donald Trump as president, right?
Michael Cohen. Let me take flipping. A second to echo that, because I've been trying out a new podcast. I'm a sucker for New York Times podcasts, I guess. And I've been listening to The Argument, where, you know, some of the opinion columnists argue about stuff on there. And to the point where I think what's amazing about the Stormy Daniels thing is you were way ahead of it. And it's so significant that, you know, Ross Douthat, the conservative columnist.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
They were kind of debating what might, you know, take down. I think they were debating. The question was, how important is this Russia stuff? Like, how much do we know about the Russia stuff with Trump? And conservative Ross Douthat said, and this is his opinion, but I think it's interesting. He said, yeah, I don't think the Russia stuff, anything that we found, is impeachable. You know, we might argue with that, but this is his opinion. However, I think the Stormy Daniels stuff is. And that's coming from a conservative. And I think that shows how important this was. And if you go back and look at the dates, how far ahead of it Andrew was. And I think it's pretty incredible. And just before anyone wonders, we also clarified later on, we're not going to play it or anything, but the lawsuit that got thrown out where Stormy Daniels may have to pay Trump's legal fees, that's a different, totally different lawsuit.
Yeah.
That didn't, a lot of people reported like this means, oh, the Stormy Daniels thing is over. No, totally different thing.
Yeah. I think a lot of folks know us from Stormy Daniels. So, you know, maybe we don't need to play a clip from that. I do want to play a clip from one of our first deep dives to really go viral and garner a lot of attention. That was episode 13, Hillary Clinton's damned emails.
Yeah.
And I was really proud of what we did in that episode. I kind of wish the Hillary Clinton campaign had done this. but what we did was go through every single published decision on the disclosure of confidential documents to debunk the claim that was circulating by then just pundit Rudy Giuliani that, you know, lock her up. This is, if Hillary Clinton's last name were Smith, she'd be busting rocks in Leavenworth. And that's not true. And I really like this small clip that talks about what that statute was actually meant to prosecute.
All right. Play it, Brian.
U.S. v. Gaffney, 1983. Same court, Air Force, staff sergeant. And here was a guy who was in the chain of command, and he was required to destroy confidential materials. Okay.
All right.
Instead, what he did was took them home with him and threw them into a dumpster by his house. And because this is 1983 and we were not all helicopter parents in 1983, kids are playing in dumpsters. And so a bunch of kids were playing in the dumpsters. They found the documents. They pulled them out. They showed them to their parents. Parents called the Air Force. And the Air Force said, what on earth are you doing? And he said, my basic intention was, this is a quote from the case.
Oh, I love it.
So I have to read it. My basic intention was, at the times when I was to do destruction, I really had wanted to be home. And then the court notes, the reason for the accused priorities is that his wife was pregnant with his first child.
Oh. Okay.
So documents clearly marked confidential. It's your job to put them through a shredder, incinerator, whatever. Instead, I'm going to take them home and throw them in a dumpster. So already from just these first two cases, you're going to see the basic fact pattern that comes up time and time again in these cases, which is to say somebody has documents, they're clearly marked confidential, they know they're confidential, they wind up in their possession either intentionally or unintentionally, and then they do something stupid like put them in a desk drawer or put them in a dumpster. They do something where they know they need to return the documents, but instead of returning the documents, they do something else.
All right. But are we, question from inquiring minds, Andrew, are we just lefty shills that we just have, truth is relative these days. We're just obviously going to be on one side of things, all the time. And we're just going to toe the Democrat line on everything.
Well, I am, but fortunately, you're no hack. No, look, one of the things that's really, really important to both of us is to police our own house and to make sure that you are bringing the same level of critical skills to a right wing or neutral piece that you would bring to a left wing piece.
But importantly, we don't have to go for the New York Times BS both sides kind of thing.
Yes.
I think that's what's great about because we don't have some weird antiquated sense of like journalistic practices where you constantly both sidesing everything and like, well, you have to just report what each side thinks and then down the middle. I love the way we're able to do it on this show, which is we still absolutely will call out when the left is wrong, especially when it's a clear law thing that Andrew's like, no, they're just wrong about this. But that doesn't at all mean that we take a both sides approach, or that the left is just as bad as the right. I think we're able to easily walk that line in a way that I'm very comfortable with, that makes sense.
Well, thanks. I appreciate that. I still get hate mail over episode 25, in which I came out and I called Jill Stein a grifter and a con artist. And I said this was the night that she announced that she was raising funds to get a recount. And the recount was going to overturn the election in Wisconsin, Michigan and Pennsylvania, and was going to make Hillary Clinton president. And why not?
Well, yeah, if only we had some record of what you said back then. Yeah, oh, I know. What do we want, Brian, why don't you play a clip? I'm talking about merely motivation and merely incentive. Like, and just logically, if there was something there, the first person who would want to capitalize is Hillary. But I was going to let you take the actual legal portion of that.
Well, this is still an opening arguments theme, right?
Which is to say...
The law often validates your common sense notions, right? And so, yes, as a common sense notion, we think if you are the person that is hurt, right, Hillary Clinton, then the person who should be filing the lawsuit should be Hillary Clinton. Mm-hmm. And that then becomes incorporated in the notion of standing by the idea that courts don't issue advisory opinions and they don't allow you to sue on somebody else's behalf, right? The idea is if you have a right that is to be vindicated, let that person bring that lawsuit. And if they choose not to, well, then the courts aren't going to get involved. And that's, that's a check and balance inherent in the judicial system that, goes all the way back to the founding of the Republic, right? It what differentiates the judiciary from the other two branches of government is that they act only defensively. They cannot proactively say, boy, this seems wrong here, and go ahead, anybody can come on in, and we're just going to say what ought to happen. So I went and I looked up the election laws in those three states. And I should add, in order for any recount to matter, Hillary Clinton has to flip the results in all three states, right? She has to flip Pennsylvania, she has to flip Wisconsin, and she has to flip Michigan. Without those three states combined, she's still shy of the 270 electoral votes necessary to become president. So if you only get two, that does you no good, right? You're in the same position you are in right now. And I would add that the additional wrinkle is you're not at the outset, you are filing an administrative petition. You are saying to the state, I want you to recount the votes. Okay. So it's a little different than bringing a lawsuit. And as it turns out, the Pennsylvania law actually allows any citizen to request a recount. The Wisconsin law is a little...
Why wouldn't someone already have done that then? Just any citizen?
Yeah, I don't know the answer to that.
Is there So there's no like further requirement?
I should add what I did, because again, this is...
You're still washing vegetables at this point.
Right, I got a turkey on the smoker and I've got half-chopped broccoli in my kitchen.
Sure.
I looked... saw the Pennsylvania law, said, oh, well, look, it says any citizen, moved on, looked at the Wisconsin law, and the Wisconsin law says any candidate. And I said, oh, well,
makes more sense.
Let me set that aside for a minute. I need to figure out how that works. Let me take a look at the Michigan law. And the Michigan law, however, is where you hit pay dirt. And as it so happens, so you can type in MC, this is the citation. It is the Michigan common law. MCL 168.862. You can type it into Google. I actually transposed the numbers the first time I reported this, and the transposition of the numbers, my law firm Twitter feed is now the number two hit on Google for the transposition. But the actual law, 168.862, describes in Michigan who's eligible to ask the state for a recount. And it says this. It says, a candidate for office who believes that he or she is aggrieved on account of fraud or mistake in the canvass or returns of the votes by the election inspectors may petition for a recount of the votes cast in any precinct or precincts as provided in this chapter. Okay. And that, I stopped then, I didn't decided not to go back and look at the Wisconsin law because that is very, very clear in terms of what it means, right? Which is to say, in order to have standing, you must not only be a candidate, but you must be a candidate who is aggrieved. And you must be a candidate who is aggrieved on account of fraud or mistake in the canvass or returns of the votes by the election inspectors. Okay. Which is to say, at the end of the day, you must be a candidate for whom requesting a recount affects your legal rights in some way. Because if it doesn't, then you have not been aggrieved by the election inspectors. So the first thing I did was I said, hey, Jill Stein is saying she's raising this money. She wants to use it for recounts in Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania. There's no way she's getting a recount in Michigan because she's not aggrieved. And the first line of argument that I got was, what are you talking about? She lost, right?
Yeah.
That you can't get more aggrieved than losing, right?
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
And to the extent that losing is being aggrieved, she was not aggrieved on account of fraud or mistake by the election officials. She was aggrieved on account of the fact that people don't like her, right? And she got 1.07% of the vote.
Yeah. And I will say, you know, it was a rough time. I don't, you know, if there are listeners or people who might have latched on to Jill Stein's plan because, you know, it was a very troublesome time. I don't blame you or anything, but that's, you know, that's why the show's here, to try to call out when people are being grifters. And as you heard in the clip, Andrew called Jill Stein out. So there you go.
And look, you know, if you're now, suppose you're on the far left, now you're saying, oh, I get it. You guys are just, you know, pro Clinton Democrats. So you're anti-Trump, but you're also happy to go after Jill Stein. Well, no, we have a bunch of episodes. The most hilariously titled one is episode 59, which was Make America Great Again, OA Defends Trump, in which we debunked a lot of bad news coming out of the left. And in particular, I kind of fisked this video from Robert Reich, who, former Clinton labor secretary, somebody who I respect. I mean, you know, just I think he's too hyperbolic with his attacks on Trump. And I think the things he's saying do not stand up to legal scrutiny, in particular in this case. So here's the clip. Yeah. I have to say, if I were a member of a democratically held House of Representatives right now, and those were the grounds for impeachment that were drawn up before me, I don't know that I could vote for that. I would not want, I mean, look, it's tough to say, I trust in the American people not to elect a callow moron as president, but the idea that a president could be impeached for the things he says about his predecessor, I wouldn't want to set that precedent, right? Like, yeah. I know how I felt as a Democrat in 2008, and certainly
because you know Mitch McConnell will take it further the next time around. By the way, once that impeachment happens, then it'll be the president looked at somebody the wrong way, and then Democrats started this.
Yeah, I mean, if you impeach President Trump for saying bad things about his predecessor. I mean, that's essentially what this comes down to. If you say that constitutes a high crime or misdemeanor, then yeah, I would be very, very concerned about what, you know, President Elizabeth Warren is going to do in 2020, you know, January 2021, in describing the mess that she's going to inherit from President Trump, right? So, you know, yeah, look, I agree presidents ought not to do this.
Well, at the same time,
okay,
it is a little weird. I know it's something we've already talked about, but it's so hard to grasp with the fact that Trump can just accuse his predecessor of a literal crime, like actually fabricate a crime that Obama did, and there's no consequences other than, well, sooner or later after he's ruined the world, then we'll vote him out of of office. Opening Arguments is brought to you by Robinhood. Robinhood is an investing app that lets you buy and sell stocks, ETFs, options, and cryptos, all commission-free. While other brokerages charge up to $10 for every trade, Robinhood doesn't charge any commission fees, so you can trade stocks and keep all of your profits. Plus, there is no account minimum deposit needed to get started, so you can start investing at any level. The simple, intuitive design of Robinhood makes investing easy for newcomers and experts alike. View easy-to-understand charts and market data, and place a trade in just 4 taps on your smartphone. You can also view stock collections, such as 100 Most Popular. With Robinhood, you can learn how to invest in the market as you build your portfolio. Discover new stocks, track your favorite companies, and get custom notifications for price movements so you never miss the right moment to invest. Robinhood is giving listeners of Opening Arguments a free stock like Apple, Ford, or Sprint to help you build your portfolio. Sign up at arguments.robinhood.com. So, Andrew, do we just talk about politics here on the show? Is that all we're focused on?
You know, I had this crazy idea when we started the show, right? And we started the show to explain legal topics in the news. And
those were the days.
Yeah, I really thought that would be non-political most of the time.
Maybe we'll eventually go through like all the major amazing Supreme Court cases throughout history and then Trump happened.
That certainly happened, and that changed the direction of the show. But one of the things that we have done since the election of Donald Trump is we've gone to twice a week. Our Friday shows are our rapid response shows. And yeah, those are typically Trump focused. Look, it would be irresponsible to do an online law school and not help you have the tools to understand what it means that appellate courts hand down injunctions blocking presidential executive orders at midnight on a Tuesday, right? That's not normal. That's weird. And you should know that it's weird. And it would be irresponsible for me not to say, you know, for me to define what an executive order is without, you know, pointing out how our president is using those executive orders. So we do the political stuff, but we also try our Tuesdays are like this show are typically set aside to be deep dive Tuesdays. And I like, you know, we've run the gamut from a lot of topics. One of the things that we did just this past year was I defined spousal privilege, right? This was in episode 99. And you know, we were talking about how it's portrayed on TV shows, right? Hmm. And you dropped a pop culture reference that, you know, went over my head as always.
Oh, Arrested Development?
Yeah, it absolutely was Arrested Development.
You can't try a husband and wife for the same crime. That's not how that works. I got the worst bleeping attorney. All right. Well, let's play a little clip. Here we go, Andrew. You ready? Let's see if you can handle this. I don't know. Because Andrew doesn't get to prep for these. So we'll have to see how lawyerly, how many belts and suspenders he has on right now.
Yeah, one of each, but keep going.
Yeah, there you go. It's a belt and a suspenders lawyer. David Dial asks, what is spousal privilege actually, and what does it cover? Because there's a lot of misunderstanding around this. There's some really good Arrested Development jokes about this, which is why I laughed, which is, I think the joke is like, they can't convict a husband and wife of the same crime. And like, that's what they think it is. So what is spousal privilege? you would love Arrested Development. You haven't watched it, but there's the Fonz plays a really terrible family attorney for them.
Henry Winkler, right?
You would love cool. it. Yes, you would love it. But anyway, what's to David Dial's question? What actually is spousal privilege?
So we have talked about privileges generally, right? And so the model that you would start. So for example, by contrast, executive privilege we talked about is a deliberative process privilege, right? You keep things quiet, you fail to disclose them so that the president knows or others with any kind of deliberative process privilege can engage in free and fair discussion, and their advisors will give them full counsel without having to run the risk that will ever become public. But the more common form of privilege that people think about are communications-based privileges, right? And that is the classic ones are attorney-client, priest-penitent, and doctor-patient, right? And what that means is when you have a communicative privilege, then the things you tell to another person, that person is prohibited by law from revealing those things. And so the spousal privilege is a kind of communicative privilege. And it says that when you engage in communications with your spouse under which there is an expectation of privacy that fit all of the other criteria for the privilege attesting, then no third party can invade that privilege, right? Can require one spouse to give testimony against the other spouse, right? Now, what kind of...
Now, can they voluntarily do it?
Right. They can.
Okay.
So...
Because a second ago, the reason I asked is a second ago, it sounded like you said they can't do it. And then you changed... The second wording sounded more like they can't be made to do it.
Yeah.
So I wasn't sure.
You can waive the privilege, right? And so the classic way in which you waive the privilege is... Right. Divorce proceedings. Right. When spouse sues the other or, you know, they're otherwise, you know, on opposite sides of the table, then, you know, the privilege no longer applies. But
now let's say question, because someone actually recovering gringo here had a follow up to this involving divorce. So you're saying at any time a spouse can decide to waive it. At any time they're like, well, I'm just going to testify against my husband or wife because I'm going to, whatever. But if they're divorced, now are they still protected for the time when they were married? So like, are they able to say, no, I don't want to do this. You can't make me testify about a time period when they were married, or does that allow them to testify about any time period?
That's a great question. Who did you say asked that one?
The recovering gringo. I modified it a little bit.
Recovering gringo. But, yeah. Good on you to recover from that. But no, great question. The privilege applies through the period. It covers the communications that were privileged at the time and survives even if the parties later get divorced. There is even, I believe, and again, remember, this isn't my area, but I'm pretty confident that that there was a case that I dimly remember from law school in which the privilege applies after one of the spouses is dead, right? So when you're, you know, in terms of producing documents to say, no, like that was a note that I gave, I think it was a love letter or something, right? Like, and they were trying to compel the production of document and the husband successfully invoked spousal privilege to keep the document out.
Okay.
So it's a strong privilege. Other things that do break the privilege are if there's a third party in the room, right? So, you know, one of the things people sometimes don't know is they think, oh, you know, you'll see this on bad cop shows. Like, I'm going to have my lawyer in the room and that's going to make everything anybody says privileged. It's actually the opposite of that, right? Like, unless it's a joint representation.
Literally the exact opposite of what you're trying to do.
Unless it's a joint representation, what that means is you've now said even the legitimate stuff, right? If you and I are talking about things and you say, oh, hey, and I want to have, you know, these five people come in the room and hang out, then like now, even when you ask me a legitimate attorney-client privileged question, the answer I give you is not going to be privileged because the presence of third parties while I give it to you vitiates the privilege.
But a clarification on that is, does that mean simply that the other people can testify about it? Or does that mean just because they were in the room, you now can make the spouse testify?
It means I can testify about it. That's exactly right. Like, it means the spouse can be compelled. Yeah, it breaks the privilege, whether it's...
just because someone else is in the room. Wow. Now, is there going to be something where they have to know someone was in the room? Is there a reasonable expectation of privacy kind of thing?
Okay. If there's somebody hiding under the bed, like that does not... That doesn't
Right. Okay. So, wow. Interesting stuff. Yeah. Maybe I could find on YouTube a compilation of all of Barry Zuckerkorn, the Fonz in Arrested Development, of all his lawyer bits. You would really get a kick out of it. It's hilarious. But that answers that question that he had. Or how about another little clip where you talk about advice on how to choose a lawyer?
You should always treat hiring a lawyer the way you would hiring a surgeon. You are always entitled to shop around. You are always entitled to a second opinion. No reasonable lawyer will be offended when you come in and say, hey, I am looking at a couple of different lawyers right now. And feel free to ask questions and say, you know, I talked to Andrew and he said, you know, X, Y, Z. How does that sound to you? I don't have nearly enough clients who say that to me.
Yeah. Will he say, don't take legal advice from a podcast? Come on, man.
It doesn't work as well. I can't say in my conference room, like, don't take legal advice from me. But that way, that also helps you in terms of price shopping. And the third thing I would add, and boy, this kills me to say, but feel free, you know, to ask when a lawyer quotes you a rate, you know, ask, is this your best rate? You know, can you discount this rate? Or in particular, ask, can I get a cap on the absolute number of hours? You know, if a lawyer says, you know, I charge $395 an hour and I estimate that this task will take 5 hours, say, okay, well, can I get a cap that says you're not going to charge me more than, you know, $2,000, which would be, you know, about 5 hours on the end of that. And all of those are, you know, valid negotiating techniques that are in.
Oh, man, we've also had our wacky and bizarre times on this show. One of the recurring themes that, you know, it's not too terribly often, but from time to time, we get to venture into absolute crazy town. And that usually involves the sovereign citizens. How about we play a little clip where you talk about some sovereign citizen
Gold
madness.
Fringe on the flag.
So there are people who believe that they are sovereign citizens, which is to say they are not legally bound to the government of the United States for various reasons. Mm. And I want to talk about the most hilarious reason why they think they're not bound. So in other words, they think that they reside in the United States, but they remain a sovereign nation unto themselves.
Yeah.
And so they kind of have this notion of engaging in diplomacy, right? Where if they say the wrong thing, they will accidentally subject themselves to the jurisdiction of the United States. And so if they don't, right, if they avoid saying that, then the United States has no jurisdiction over them and they don't have to pay their taxes. And in addition to that, like there's some amazing videos, and I'm going to try and link to some in the show notes that are talking about, you know, you don't have to pay speeding tickets either, and you don't have to, you know, appear.
Yeah, but
for
you can
warrants.
Use the roads, though. That's cool. Right. You just don't have
well, you
to
know,
pay.
Yes, because you're a sovereign nation, and they're extending you, you know, diplomatic immunity. Like, didn't you see Lethal Weapon 2? Like, that means you know, you can run around and shoot people and everything. So the most amazing thing, I cannot tell you how much research this took to figure this out. They believe that your birth certificate sets up a fictitious legal corporation. Okay. Here's how it works. As far as I can tell, if we have any sovereign citizens in our listening audience, please send us an email to openarguments@gmail.com. Because if I'm getting this wrong,
If you send an email, you're no longer sovereign.
I would love to know the crazy. And I love this because the one website I saw that was making this advice you'll appreciate this. They said, well, let's look at what the legal definition of certificate is. And they pulled out a banking dictionary, right? Oh, and it says, gosh. You know, certificate is, you know, a device for the transfer of wealth and, you know, an instrument for, right? Which, I mean, you think about it in your profession, right? Like that certainly is one use of the term.
Yeah.
But, you know, it also just
There's another use of it, which is certifiable, but that's another story.
It means a piece of paper, right? Yeah. But in the banking industry, which is what they're quoting, right? A certificate, right? Like a certificate of deposit does indeed mean, you know, you are transferring ownership. So they say when you have a birth certificate, you are now transferring the ownership of you as a sovereign entity to this fictitious corporation.
So it's a receipt, essentially.
Exactly. And the evidence of the conspiracy is your birth certificate is issued in all capital letters. Your name will be spelled on that in all capital letters. And then they say, this is the doctrine of capitis diminutio maxima. The Latin phrase capitis diminutio maxima, and it means the maximum loss of status. Okay. As it turns out, if you look up that Latin, it does indeed mean the maximum loss of status. But the sleight of hand that they're engaging in here is it doesn't have anything to do with capital letters. Right. They're just saying like capital letters and capitis kind of sound similar, and capitis diminimo maxima means maximum loss of status. So when you subscribe to something and accept anything that is written in all capital letters, you are selling yourself into slavery. Gosh. And you are giving up all of your rights. So the way you can tell these sovereign citizen people is they will appear in court and they will designate themselves on their papers with their name in all lowercase letters, okay? And they'll put a punctuation mark, usually a colon, after their first name.
You know, that is great. Also, one of my absolute favorites, I cannot believe it's been so long since Earthlaw, Earthport. this involved my high school, right?
It did. Wow. Oh, this is one of my favorites. Stick around to the end of the clip when you hear about the Penguin Supreme Court. This is great.
Nice.
He's an anti-vaxxer, right? And he helps represent people who want to get exemptions to the California mandatory vaccination law. I've pulled this question because people might not be convinced yet. You shouldn't be convinced yet that he's a crazy person. You have to listen to the rest of this. Question, are vaccines good for everyone? Answer, vaccines are literally, quote, drugs, end quote. I am not a doctor, but I think vaccines should only be for people who desire to inject themselves with drugs. I agree with the doctors who say that clean living and natural immunity and wholesome food and traditional care is good for us. Ultimately, the reason that people hand over their children to the injections of the pharmaceutical industry, by the way, interesting use of the English language there, is because of fear. Is that fear warranted? I don't think so. I think we should strive towards developing natural immunity and intelligent natural remedies. All right. So that's neat. And I'm going to link his blog.
Vaccines are drugs and therefore should only be used on people who want to inject drugs into them.
Yeah.
Wow. I've never heard that.
Okay. So he's got this, and I'm going to link his blog. He's got multiple blogs. I do not know why, because
one wasn't enough.
He doesn't update any of them frequently, but I guess he didn't want his
he probably
you know,
forgets
real estate
that he made
peanut butter
the last
getting
one.
Mixed up with his. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Oh, sorry. He probably forgets that he made the last one. Is like, oh, I need to make a totally rambling, crazy blog. I forgot. And he like forgets the login information for the last one he made and then he makes a new one.
I think that's probably right. Because I was going with he didn't want to get his, you know, real estate chocolate mixed up with his anti-vax peanut butter. But like none of these are updated frequently. It's weird. He also has a love for the ampersand that I have not seen since my high school poetry teacher, Gary Blankenberg, way back in my sophomore year of high school, who like always would write poems.
And is that his real name or you just don't want to curse on the show?
Yeah. Gary Blankenberg. So shout out to Catonsville High School peeps who remember. All right. So he's got this weird anti-vax blog. Does he have anything else that's crazy, you ask?
Yes, I do ask.
Oh, yes. So he also maintains, and all of these, by the way, are linked off of his firm website. Right now, look at, and in fairness, right, you go to my firm website, you get linked to Opening Arguments, and you know you can certainly cull things that I have said on Opening Arguments.
Yeah, they're virtually the same as saying we need clean, natural, natural immunity. I don't know how that works with some of these things, but okay.
So he maintains obviously he's a religious nut too. He maintains a blog called logicalhierarchy.com. And the logical hierarchy is Bible studies, non-denominational with a focus on mathematics and logic. Right. So, all right, what? I think mathematics and logic, I think, you know, okay, symbolic logic. I'm going to read some dense philosophy papers. I'd like to read you a little bit from his post, September 22nd, 2015, the number 19.
Oh, fantastic.
Why do we want to know about the number 19? Yeah, because in biblical Hebrew, one name for God is Allah, A-L-H-A. I've never seen that before, but yeah. Well, yeah, whatever. I'm going to take his
I'll
word
trust
for
him.
It. Right? I'm
not, he seems reputable.
Using simple gematria, I love that. Where Aleph equals one.
So don't worry. Nobody, two. There's no complicated gematria, everybody. We're just simple gematria.
Simple entry level gematria 101. The total of these letters is 19. So Alha equals 19. And then 19 is a super special number.
And prime number.
I'm just going to read, right? When this is, and I want to emphasize, I can only tell you, I'm going to link this. You can verify this for yourself. I am neither adding nor removing. There are no ellipses. This
well,
is word
it's
for
important
word
to not add or says. Remove any words because when we do elementary gematria to add up the numbers of it, we need to have it totally intact. So I'm glad you're keeping the language intact.
When two, dragon number, tries to divide seven, messiah number, the triumph is given to the Messiah to be born into three and therefore sit at the right hand of the Father, that is nine, at the top of the hierarchy. The Messiah also receives eight, 3 + 5 = 8, duh. Oh, sorry, that duh is my commentary there.
Yeah.
The Messiah also receives 8, 3 + 5 = 8, representing the new world / age created after seven, this world / age. That was a challenge to parse out.
I feel like you ruined it with your editorializing. It would have been fine, but since poisoned the well. I'm just trying to learn, Andrew, and your, you know, your negativity.
All right. No commentary. He asked the rhetorical question. What else does Rodin's diagram mean in Hebrew? Mm-hmm. I'd like to learn too. Well, in Hebrew, 369 spells GVT. Which is a mysterious expression. A human could say it means majesty, just as readily as she could say it means connection, pride, friction, growth, or expansion. Or if you read it backwards, 963, TVG, the meaning is equally mysterious, as one might say it means pride,
also,
voice, friction,
why is
violence,
six afraid
or crown.
Of seven?
Now, your comment, you wanted to learn. There's one more sentence here. Or two more sentences, sorry. As these expressions manifest themselves in our universe, we expect and make relative choices to fulfill the destiny of our story that was born from the beginning as word. As long as there is a one in the equation, then zero will always be kept from triumph.
I cannot wait for this person. By the way, this is Trump's next appointee to the federal.
So, okay, all right. So he's anti-vax. He's engaged in numerological gematria and thinks 19 is a magic number and that the one prevents the zero from triumphing, which given that he composed this on a computer that is entirely, you know, composed of ones and zeros and its processing, whatever. Okay. You might ask yourself, but surely he has relevant legal interests, right?
Well, we know he defends separation of powers because that's something.
Yeah. Says on his website that he is also the founder of an organization that I cannot find anything about. I have Googled. I have looked, called Everyday Currency. I have some guesses what it might be about, but they have zero website presence, zero legitimate Googleable website presence. I don't know. They might be all over the dark web. I have no idea. But he also founded something called the Civil Action Network, and that I can access is www.civilactionnetwork.org. And that does not instantly appear to be something that was created by crazy person. It has a little drop down tag for referenda, right? And referenda, that makes total sense. Right?
That's because, a real word.
Yeah, from living in California. California has the most referenda, which are ballot initiatives that are placed on the ballot that voters get to vote on in every election.
Are we about to add up the numbers that make up the word referenda and then see how – or no, we on to actual legal stuff.
Oh, it's so much better than that. So I clicked on the referenda tab. Right. And I was like, OK. And the mouse over, by the way, in referenda says, hammer out some legislation with fellow CAN users. Right. The Civil Action Network. OK. So what referenda might Mr. Glazer want to put on the California ballot?
Prop 8.
There's one tab, one item comes up on the referenda page. It is entitled Earth Constitution. I'm going to read you a little bit. From Mr. Glazer's proposed Earth Constitution. Article 1, Section 1. The United Nations is hereby abolished, and its authority to work justice is transferred to a new governing authority with jurisdiction across Earth, which shall be called Earth Government. The individual humans of the world hold and maintain legislative authority over the Earth Government. All right.
Okay. But good start to Earth
bit,
Government.
A little bit odd to introduce in California, but, you know, okay. I'm a globalist. I can go with it, right? Yeah, Article 3, Section 1. The judicial power.
The California voters have decided. Earth Government, everyone.
But it's going to have to be ratified by the citizens of the Earth. But okay. I guess it gets introduced in California.
Yeah. You the judicial start power.
This is my favorite one because I think there's a good loophole here for you. Mm. Article 3, Section 1, the judicial power for the Earth Government shall be vested in one Supreme Court, operating above seven regional courts. Each continent represents its own region.
Uh-huh.
So I just want to point out, if you to get to seven, this means there will be a Supreme Court for Antarctica. So I think Thomas Smith. I feel like
that one's
Smith,
not going to get as much, you know, court traffic as some of the other court circuits.
You know, probably not. But
I can't wait for our first injunction that comes from Antarctica, like a penguin, just injunction on something we're doing here in North America.
Each Supreme Court shall have 12 judges, each elected for a 10-year term, and under Section 8, the personal salary of an elected judicial officer is 100 ounces of gold per year. So... So I just want to point out, we could get a dozen people to be the Supreme Court of Antarctica. We could get 5 or 6 people and 6 or 7 penguins and distribute out 1,200 ounces of gold.
Yeah.
Yeah. 1,200 ounces of gold. And
that might be a lot. That might be a lot of money. Isn't an ounce of gold like $1,000 or something?
So the spot price of gold per ounce as we record this is $1,281.80. So
it's a good living. Means, I like how his first $128,000 like concern when writing a treatise on a new Earth government is like, but how much are the judges going to make on when they're appointed for tenure. That is, I love that. The detail. How long is this document that you're reading?
You can, it is, it has 9 articles, but includes with it section 21 of Article 8 says, the following codes attached to this constitution shall apply to all jurisdictions on earth as legislation passed pursuant to Article 1. And that is penal code, civil code, environmental, evidence and trial procedure. So all of these would be, you know, are thousands and thousands of pages, right? You would want to replicate.
Is he just adding in? So that's him like cut and paste in the U.S. code or like elements of the U.S.?
Well, he doesn't define what these are. I mean, maybe. I spent a lot of time.
Oh, like he's got some other attachments somewhere that he's.
He might, but I can't find them.
Okay.
But I like it will also include the Worldwide Jubilee Declaration. So that's probably shorter.
Oh, man.
But my favorite provision and the reason for that.
How do you pick a favorite, though?
Oh, I know.
Antarctica Court is already up there.
Antarctica Court is high. A penguin can eke out a pretty good living on $128,000.
What are you doing with gold?
Do you have
in
any
Antarctica?
Idea how many sardines that will buy? No, but the reason for my including the Van Halen classic Love Walks In the intro for this, thank Brian for putting that together on short notice, is Article 8, Section 16, which I have to read to you.
Okay.
Intelligent extraterrestrial individuals.
I knew it. I knew we would. Right when he started with Earth Court and Earth Law, I was like, there's going to be like a Vulcan law or like a. Like a Corellian, whatever the alien, the weird alien names, it's gonna come up. Okay, here we go.
But by birth, within the, intelligent extraterrestrial individuals may become citizens of the Earth by birth within the territorial borders of the Earth, right? So ET anchor babies. Adoption. So again, ET. Or long-term acceptance into the family and home of any citizen of the Earth. Status as a political refugee recognized by the president upon arrival to the Earth.
Is there an Earth president?
I wanted that. Excellent point. I looked through this document.
I think I found a hole. Hold on. I think I found a problem with this document.
This document uses the word president twice and only in this section. It does not tell us who the president is. The head of the Earth government is and I'm sorry I have to say this, Article 2, Section 1, the executive power of the Earth government shall be vested in a chief caretaker. The chief caretaker shall hold office for a term of 4 years. Votes to elect an executive may be submitted at any time during the spring of the appropriate year in the 4-year cycle. The chief caretaker shall publish all Earth government laws in the languages used by the nations. So, no, there's no president in this document. So there is maybe there will be a president whose sole job it is to decide whether intelligent extraterrestrial aliens are political refugees.
There's a lot of penguins with nothing else to do in Antarctica Court. So they could probably, if we want to outsource that to Antarctica Court, then they could make that determination.
I wanted to give him the benefit of the doubt. And I thought maybe he first called it president and then changed it to chief caretaker later and just, you know, forgot to in this passage. But no, it says status as a political refugee recognized by the president upon arrival to the Earth or by work visa, as the president may issue at the discretion of the executive branch. Then it says the chief caretaker and Earth government judiciary shall have the power to regulate citizenship and the Earth's territorial integrity, including by intergalactic cooperation in matters of law enforcement to ensure that individuals entering the Earth are not fleeing justice. So I guess I'm
tired of people coming to this planet, aliens coming to this planet, fleeing. They're not sending us their best aliens, Andrew. Yeah,
they've got calves the size of cantaloupes. Yeah.
I like the part where you have to, if you're born in the borders of Earth, like how do you define the border? Is that orbit? Is that, what are the borders?
It's that level of insight that is going to make you an outstanding Supreme Court justice for the territory.
Well, I feel like before, I mean, this is a good start on this document. But before we adopt it, I just think we ought to, you know, We got to go over it a little and just make a few edits. A few, you got your red, red felt tip pen.
You might.
A few pointers.
And I should add, the environmental caretaker anchor baby extraterrestrial aliens does not contradict, in his mind, Article 7, Section 1, which says, towards the goal of respecting our Creator in heaven, the lawful and traditional nation of Israel remains fully sovereign, and the King of Israel may choose whether to comply with this constitution at any given time and space.
And space? What is that?
I'm pretty sure that Israel does not have a king. Maybe this is like a crazy dominionist.
There's a prime minister, isn't there?
End times thing. Yeah, I know. I'm pretty sure they don't have a king. So that was also neat.
Oh, those were the days, Andrew. So what happened, you know, to us over these past few years?
If a certain thing had not happened, we would just be continuing to put out, you know, the occasional goofball Sovereign Citizen episode, and then we would do deep dives of the kind we still try and do. So, for example, I don't want to play a clip from it, but I want to plug. I was really proud of the episode that we did on PG&E and the California wildfires.
Yeah.
That was episode 241. I told you in that episode things looked real bad for PG&E, and a couple days later, they announced that they were declaring bankruptcy. So, yeah, we would be doing all that, except that through bizarre machinations, we managed to elect a criminally insane game show host as president who is looting the public treasury. And so a week into the Trump administration, I'm not making this up, a week into the Trump administration was when we got our first question of, when can we impeach this guy already?
Yeah.
And so I answered that in episode 45. And this is probably the number one question we get about the show these days, because we play the little clip of Yodel Mountain and people will say, what on earth is Yodel Mountain and what does it mean? Well, this is what it means.
Origin
Brian,
story?
If you can play the clip. Yeah.
The birth of Yodel Mountain. Here it is.
Because people have got to know whether or not their president's a crook.
Nobody, so you're not aware of any context during the course of the election?
How many times do I have to answer this question?
Can you just say
Russia
yes or no
is
on
a
it?
Ruse. I know you have to get up and ask a question so important. Russia is a ruse.
Well, I'm not a crook.
All right. Time for, new segment. You excited for our new segment, Andrew?
I am very excited for this new segment.
Let's hope the person we pay to do this kind of stuff, a.k.a. me, made a nice intro for us. This is a new segment that I think we could do every week. It should be pretty easy. And I think it'll be applicable for roughly 2 years in my best guess. But we'll see. The new segment is, how close is Trump to being impeached? how much longer can he possibly go? So today's version of that has to do with Flynn. Everybody will probably know. Of course, we record ahead of time. So around this time that we're recording is when we found out that National Security Advisor Flynn has resigned, been kind of made to resign. And there's a question over whether or not he broke the law, whether or not Trump knew what he knew. There's all that stuff. There's going around, again, drawing more similarities to Nixon. What did they know and when did they know it, essentially? So this kind of comes from a question that Matt Vernon sent us, and it has to do with 18 USC 1001, which I remember from previous episodes, Andrew. That's the way you usually cite the law, so that's good. That's a good sign. Matt wanted to know whether or not this could be grounds for, because the reason we decided to do the segment is basically every week there's several questions of like, wait, well, what about this? Is this going to be the thing that gets Trump impeached? Is this going to be the thing? So we'll just do a standard segment on that now every week. So how about it, Andrew? Is this the thing that's going to get Trump impeached?
So I like to view this as, do you remember the mountain climber on The Price is Right that would yodel and move up the ruler? And when he got to I think 35, he fell off the mountain, right? And,
oh, man. Maybe I should try to find that for the intro that back in time everyone already heard. But anyway. Right. We'll see. Maybe they heard that and they'll be like, oh, yeah.
Maybe they heard that. Yeah. But, that, you know, so I view each one of these that we come up with is just another step up the mountain. And eventually he will fall off the mountain. Let's just hope that the mountain is
is only as high as it was on The Price is Right.
All right. You know, another reference, while we're talking about references we frequently make, is Clear as Kushner. Why don't we play a little clip of where that came from?
Like, there is not, it is, to make an argument for Jared Kushner requires you to be either willfully ignorant of the law or deliberately obfuscatory, right? Like, that is a clear violation of the anti-nepotism statute. You know, this is not as clear as Kushner, but it is certainly...
I like that. That's a new, that's a new
clear
phrase.
Clear as Kushner. There we go.
It's as clear as Kushner that he's violating this law. Yeah.
But it's pretty bad.
I like it. Hashtag clear as Kushner.
There we go.
Well, we take ourselves awful seriously on this show. Sometimes too seriously, but other times not very seriously at all.
Yeah, this was a very, very important segment about a very, very important principle of the law. And I think you'll hear us not be able to contain ourselves at that legal principle.
Really, the subject of production to itself, right? And the way in which that happens is via what we call a taint team. So it means this. Yeah. This is not an explicit episode, so we're not going to go through.
We're just going to be straight faced about our taint team.
We're going to be straight faced.
This is an actual legal term.
It is actual legal term.
Legal dorks.
Yeah. And what you do is you put another layer of lawyers that are not working on the Michael Cohen criminal investigation in between the documents and the prosecutors, right?
I can't help it. I'm sorry.
It's okay. It's okay.
The taint team is, you're saying it's a team that's in between two, like the lawyers and
right.
the okay.
Right. It serves to separate the lawyers who are prosecuting Michael Cohen from the.
I feel like I know which end of the taint team Sean Hannity is, but. All right. This lawyers, is not an explicit show. Right. Okay. Taint team. They're totally normal legal things. No,
who
no
are making the privilege determination. And, so, and seriously, you do this all the time. It used to be called, this is now no longer a remotely appropriate term, but it used to be called a Chinese wall. So I guess going from Chinese wall to taint team seems more politically
correct these days. Immature joke is way better than racism. So they're just like, all right, close enough.
And I think I'm with them on that, right?
Like, yeah. So it's like the Futurama joke where they changed Uranus to Erectum.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So right now there are lawyers busily at work who have nothing to do with the investigation, who do not care about the substance of the document in any way whatsoever, who are reviewing documents to determine whether they are on face privileged, right? And they
Go taint team.
Yes. And they will apply the standard test, right? Which is not just, is a lawyer copied on this? Because we know they're Cohen's documents. Obviously, they all are. It is, does the material seek legal advice from an identified client? And if it does, then they will prepare what's called a privilege log, which is an Excel spreadsheet that just has columns for the author, the recipient, any copies, the subject matter, title of the document, when it was issued, you know, basic information like that. So
this seems to me is to be the obvious, the very rational way to go about something like this, where you want to respect attorney-client privilege, of course, but you've got a criminal who you've proven to a judge, or at least given enough evidence to a judge that, hey, we can't just let this guy. It's like asking, you know, I don't know, Al Capone to decide like which evidence to give us or something.
It is exactly in a callback to our what was so bad about Watergate episode, right? That it was what made Nixon's proposal first to review the tapes himself and then second to have, you know, deaf racist Senator John Stennis review the materials. Right. You don't want those materials to be in the hands of the person that you think has likely committed a crime.
But at the same time, it's pretty tyrannical to just say, now the government will decide, you know, so they have a taint team.
Yes, exactly.
of people who are disinterested parties, I guess. And they can say, okay, this seems to be privileged information.
Yep.
Or not.
That's exactly right.
Makes sense. Okay.
So that's the underlying legal basis. there is still pending the request by Cohen, which was joined by Trump, to appoint a special master. And let me explain what that is and what that would do. From a strategic perspective, if you're Michael Cohen, the first thing you want to do in this investigation is destroy evidence, right? So you'd like to be the one in charge of the documents and what gets turned over. You lost on that. So your fallback position is, well, okay, if I can't destroy evidence, I would like to slow this down as much as possible. I would like to delay and obstruct and make it difficult. And in particular, if you're doing that because you're trying to front for the president, obviously, you know, there is a clock that can be run out on the president. So,
And especially trying to get this stuff delayed till after midterms, because, you know, the more Democrats have to run on the midterms, the worse.
Exactly right. So a special master is typically in the federal courts, it's a magistrate judge who is not the presiding judge in the case, who is then appointed to handle discovery disputes. Right. And again, this is a procedure that I see all the time in my day-to-day job, civil litigation. It's particularly in huge cases, right? I had a 9-year-long insurance coverage case, and we produced millions of documents. And what you don't want to do is you don't want to overburden a judge who has 500 cases on her docket over the course of the year, right? If all of a sudden now all of those cases, all of the questions about documents had to go to the presiding judge, right? Like, literally only 2% of cases go to trial now, and that would be 0.002% of cases, right? So you appoint a special master, and the special master gets to hear all of the disputes. So as you can imagine, if you were to appoint a special master in this case, it would insert a level of bureaucracy in between the government and Judge Kimball Wood, who is presiding over this matter. And the government would be able to file a ton of these motions, get hearings on them, right? The government would have, you know, the special master would have to review the document. It would delay things, right? And so Judge Wood's order on Monday was for the government to proceed with the use of the taint team to prepare summaries of the document, to upload all of the material into a database that that attorneys typically use, that will then, you know, scan and sort the documents and, you know, be able to tell us. So we will know of the documents seized by the government, right, how many pages that entails and what percentage of those documents belong to the three people that have been alleged to have been clients of Michael Cohen.
Right.
And they'll have to turn over that database, summary database, to Cohen's lawyers. Right. And so Judge Wood says, after the material has been uploaded, we will know more about the volume and the content of the documents, and we can make a more intelligent choice as to whether a taint team or a special master should be involved in the process of determining what is and what is not protected by attorney-client privilege. This is more from Judge Wood's rulings. I envision a test. As soon as we see the documents, I want a proposal for how to move quickly on this. So there you go. That's how we're going to go forward. The next step in this process is going to be the government's production of a summary of the status of the documents to Michael Cohen and to President Trump, and presumably to Sean Hannity, of how many documents are there, how many identify your particular client, how many identify particular attorney-client privilege, and what's the test? How are we going to go forward and ensure that the attorneys within the DOJ who are potentially prosecuting Michael Cohen do not get to see documents that shouldn't get to see? And again, I want to go back to that bottom line, right? Like, I'm a lawyer. Attorney-client privilege is super important to me.
Yeah.
And I do not want us on the left to race because, you know, Cohen is, you know, a fixer scumbag and we want to bring down President Trump. I do not want us to race to the point where we are blithely turning over attorney-client privilege materials.
All right, go taint team!
I've been in a fool that has to work the taint.
Oh, we're just going to be straight-faced about our taint team? I can't help it, I'm sorry.
I love it when a case comes together.
Ah, what a trip down memory lane. Good times, Andrew. Good times. Yeah. It's been a good 250. And of course, happy 250.
Happy 250 to you, Thomas.
All right. Let's quit. Show's over. No, not good. Not really. We got to do another, at least 750. We got to get to 1,000. Then really, then we can do a nested clip show of clip shows. We can be like, remember the clip show we did?
like that. What was that? Like season 12 of The Simpsons where they did the clip show of clip shows. Yeah.
Oh, they did. Oh man. Here. I thought that was my idea. All right. Yeah. Well,
Simpsons already
did it. Simpsons has done everything. They have 30 seasons of show. All right. Well, we've got to do the
six
thing
that are really good.
Yeah. Six or seven, maybe eight. We've got to do the thing we do every Tuesday, which is to thank our new patrons at patreon.com/law. All right, Andrew, take it away.
Yeah, thank you to Jacob Glowacki, to Wookie. Thanks, Leah, for telling me about opening arguments. Yeah, well, we thank Leah, too. To Jordan, to the Chris. That was in all caps, so I figured it was a wrestling name or something. To Kevin Walorski, to, or else, what are we even doing here? To Eli Bosnick's favorite clown horn, and to Trinity. Thank you all so much for supporting the show.
And thank you, Michelle Altabella, Han Patreon, Bowers is Dead, Overturn High Tech Gays v. Disco, April Gonzalez, Adam Krushek, Jaws 1430, and Andrew slowly explaining political fluff. And Andrew slowly explaining political philosophy is my kink.
Well, I'm glad it is for someone. Thank you.
Good times. And we've got to do the thing we do every week, which is Thomas takes the bar exam. I have no legal training, but I've attempted to take the bar exam, and I'm doing not as badly as you might think, but sometimes very badly, depending on which week it is. And let's find out how I did on question 112.
Oh, no associate of this firm has ever failed the bar exam.
No kidding.
Yeah, and let me say, I'm glad we get to bookend with this, right? Because you said at the beginning of the show that, you know, the law is complicated and we're sort of here to navigate you through that. That's true. But one of the messages that I love about this show, one of our underlying themes, is that if you bring common sense and pay attention, that the law isn't always arcane, isn't always indecipherable. And I will tell you that particularly when I'm talking to lawyers, but usually when I'm just talking about the show to anybody, the first segment I explain that we do is Thomas Takes the Bar Exam. I love this. I love the fact that what I'm doing is asking you real bar exam prep questions, and the folks get to hear you puzzle through that, play along, and see if you're right or wrong on the air. This is it's my favorite segment of the show, and it's a thing that I promote the most, that I think really kind of drives home our message that you can understand this. It doesn't, it's not all 13th century Saxony. With that in mind, here was your question, number 112. This involved a man who was despondent and angry over having lost his job, went to a bar while contemplating suicide, had a pistol in his pocket, got drunk at the bar. Some clown horn in a MAGA hat next to him was like, well, you know, I think downsizing is important to keep the economy strong. Our protagonist, question mark, turns over, says, hey, buddy, why don't you shut the hell up? The MAGA hat wearing guy says, hey, it's a free country. I can do whatever I want. And then the despondent laid off man pulls out the gun, shoots MAGA hat dead. And then the question is he guilty of first degree murder, second degree murder, or manslaughter? And Thomas, you felt that this was a supremely easy question. You went
famous last words
immediately to D. You're like, this kind of seems like a second degree murder thing, right? He's there. He's drunk in a bar. Doesn't really seem like it's a deliberation, even though deliberation can take place in an instant. Doesn't really seem like manslaughter because, you know, he shot the guy. So second degree murder, that was answer D. And I am happy to tell you, answer D is correct.
All right.
This could not have planned this any better for this episode, right? The other answers were A, manslaughter, because there was a reasonable explanation for his becoming enraged. That's not right. There's no reasonable explanation for becoming enraged. That guys just saying stuff to you, that is not, I get to shoot you now, even in Donald Trump's America. B was first degree murder because deliberation can take place in an instant. That's true, but the drunken anger is typically not the kind of law requires.
Deliberation. Yeah.
Cool deliberation. No.
I mean, unless he looked really cool doing it. Like if he was just wearing, if he was wearing that mesh see-through outfit from Lot Awful Movies 26, then maybe any deliberation is cool deliberation.
Yep. So you successfully saw through that. And that was your second choice answer. And I agree that that was the only one that had a plausible chance of being correct. C was first degree murder because he contemplated taking a human life before becoming intoxicated. And you said, well, yeah, his own, right? Because he was thinking about suicide. And you correctly pointed out that the statute requires of another person. I want to flag this because there are lawyers who got this bar question wrong. Right. Part of what the bar does to trip you up is sometimes get you to overthink things. Right.
Right.
And, and if you're sitting there going, OK, well, all right, I guess technically it was right. You could easily sort of elide over that without kind of giving it the common sense check in the background. So C also incorrect for the reasons that you stated. You analyzed this exactly perfectly, got it exactly right. You are now 65 for 112. That is 58%. That is tantalizingly close to 60%.
Flirting with 60.
Yeah, which is about the level you need to pass the bar. And as I tell lawyers all the time, right, you're way higher. You are significantly higher on statistical chance, right, which would put you at 25%.
Right.
So,
you know,
doing twice as good as blind chance, I think, when I tell lawyers that, they're like, no, come on. And you're doing great. So there we go.
Thank you very much. Wow. Yeah, that one, I'm glad it was as straightforward as I thought it was. Sometimes they're not, but sometimes they are. All right. Well, Andrew, hop in your time machine where you go into the future when people have had time to respond to the episode that we've recorded recently and tell us who this week's lucky winner of TTTBE is.
Yeah, this week's winner is lucky not only for winning, but for winning and going into special episode 250, which, we're going to try and promote and share far and wide.
One.
So, this may truly be never-ending fame and fortune, but that's not guaranteed.
Meanwhile, at the Hall of Justice.
Well, Thomas, we had a lot of great entries this week, including poetry, but I think the winner ought to go to a longtime patron, first-time TTTB winner, Milo Meadsong, that is at Milo Meadsong on Twitter, who writes, "It's D. I know when I'm poked by a particularly chaotic neutral ogre, I fly into a heat of passion to try and take them down. Go get them, Thomas." So, way to commit to a bit, Milo Meadsong, the halfling bard, and SIU3L. Congratulations on being this week's winner. Everyone give Milo a follow. That is at MiloMeadsong. And congratulations.
All right. Thanks so much for listening. And if you're new to the show, I hope you like what you hear and stick with us. I promise that it really is the best way to make sense of a lot of complex stuff. And Andrew, happy 250. Listeners, happy 250. We wouldn't be able to do it without you and patrons alike. So thank you guys.
Yeah.
We'll see you on Friday for probably Yodel Mountain.
Definitely.
You betray the law!
This has been Opening Arguments with Andrew and Thomas. If you love the show and want to support future episodes, please visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/law. If you can't support us financially, it'd be a big help if you could leave us a 5-star review on iTunes, Stitcher, or whatever podcast delivery vehicle you use. And be sure to tell all your friends about us. For questions, suggestions, and complaints, email us at openarguments@gmail.com. The show notes and links are on our website at www.openargs.com. Be sure to like our page on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at OpenArgs. Until next time. This podcast is a production of Opening Arguments Media, LLC. All rights reserved.
Opening Arguments is produced with the assistance of our editor, Brian Ziegenhagen, our production assistant, Ashley Smith, and our researcher, Deborah Smith. Special thanks to Teresa Gomez and the entire OA Wiki team. Follow them at OA Wiki. And a big thank you to our Facebook group moderators, Alicia Cook, Natalie Newell, Emily Waters, Eric Brewer, and Brian. Check out the Opening Arguments Facebook community. And finally, thanks to Thomas Smith for creating the show's theme song, which is used with permission.